Hello, everyone. My name is Kellen, and I'm joined here by my co-hosts. We are a part of Professor Lively's class, and we're going to be today talking about the Coast Watchers of the Pacific and how they served in our victory against the Japanese in World War II. Today, we'll begin.
Me, Brady Allen. Anyway, I'll be giving you a little history lesson, a little background summary, all that stuff. Nothing specific, though. That's what everyone else is here for. So, for the Coast Watchers, it's an organization established a year after World War I ended in 1919 by the Royal Australian Navy by some dude named Captain J.G. Glare.
J.G.
Yeah. Don't know much about him. Then again, though, he could have just been random Navy captain, so maybe not too important. And the Coast Watchers were an organization made up of basically just civilian volunteers.
Just local.
Some brave souls.
Brave souls. Not necessarily. They didn't have to be brave at the time. Because their original goal was to essentially just watch out for any sort of unusual shipping activities in the Pacific Islands. Well, okay. Specifically the northern parts of Australia or the islands north of Australia.
Important bits, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And their group mostly consisted of, you know, missionaries, locals, business managers, people who had connections to the area.
Oh, and that's neat.
Yeah. Everyone who knew everyone. And the initial islands that they watched over were Australia, Papua, and New Guinea. But by the mid-1920s, their coast watching included the Bismarck Archipelago. And around a decade or two after that, their new commanding officer, Royal Australian Navy Officer Eric Felt, was put in charge because he was an islander who lived there for around 16 years or so.
Hey, he knew his stuff, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he knew people.
Yeah.
That's kind of the main goal of this, is the people who know people. Yeah. Yeah. Who can watch out for shady shit.
All that.
Anyway. As for what they did when actual war broke out in World War II, they kind of just gathered intelligence and reported that to the Office of Naval Intelligence, or the equivalent of that. But after a while, when proper fighting broke out in the Pacific, when the United States rolled in, essentially, they started to do guerrilla stuff, going full Vietnam on the Japanese.
Hey, you need to do it sometimes. It was necessary, you know? Necessary.
It's the tactics.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, my name's Caden. I'm going to be talking about some of the personal qualifications of these brave souls that volunteered. At first, in the beginning, I know that they kind of accepted any volunteers. It was mostly just like, hey, who wants to go out there and, you know, do this?
Fight for America. The good fight. We need you.
For America.
Yes.
For Australia.
Well, you know, they ran into some, trouble real soon, you know, because they were like, wow, these dudes ain't really experienced, you know. And they sent them out there and they were just like, not doing what they should have been doing.
It was a dangerous job.
Well, yeah. That's the problem with an entirely volunteer-based force.
Yeah. So literally after that, they were like, okay, we have to have some, like, you know, qualifications. We got to have some stuff to, limit down the people who were going.
Can't just have Ma and Pa going sneaking behind Japanese lines.
Yeah, you need someone who can represent. So most of the people that, you know, like ideal picks, they were young people. They had to have some type of military experience. You know, they went through small arms training and a little bit of coding. I also will say that they really wanted someone that knew how to, like, who knew the land, knew the landscape and, like, the people there. They also wanted them to be able to speak, I think it's called pidgin.
Yeah, local language.
Yep. I seen that it only took a year to, you know, be able to understand, especially if you already know English. Mm. So, I mean, that's kind of easy, I think.
Yeah, that and the fact that pidgin's mostly just really, really mashed together English.
Wasn't it 90% English?
Oh, yeah.
It's other native languages.
So I definitely think, you know, people who know English could figure it out, mm-hmm. especially yeah. quick. The main thing of their, after their, you know, qualifications is this term of going bush.
Mm.
So it kind of ties back into what they expected these recruits to be able to know. So they wanted them to have knowledge of the country and natives, you know.
Neat.
They wanted them to know, about primitive trails and stuff that are, you know, in that land. And they wanted them to have really good judgment when it comes to making decisions.
I mean, kind of some common sense.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying.
So like the primary coast watcher would be someone who is like reasonably competent and has some survival skills. Yeah.
They wanted someone who like, you know, made some sense.
Yeah.
Especially when it came to affiliating with like the locals there and like where, like who to get food from, who to tell, like, hey, we're, you know, so and so, we're trying to go here kind of thing.
Right. Because it's a complex job.
I think so, yeah.
That and the fact that secrecy is everything with this job.
And there's real danger involved.
You don't get caught.
So, I mean, they were also very like reinforced the idea of this. It's called Ferdinand Code. It reminded them not to fight unless they absolutely had to. Mm. So they didn't really want, you know, people to do anything other than gathering intel and kind of just reporting in if, like, they really had to. They didn't want, you know, these people to go out there and blow stuff up and do any type of, like, you know, like, big operation kind of thing.
Yeah, don't risk yourself, huh?
Yeah. And they also had this other cool thing called the four-man rule. I thought it'd be cool to include. They said one man was too much strain on one person, so they couldn't have just one man. They said with two men, it was not enough for continuous work. You know, one person could sleep, but, you know, you still need, you know, more than two people. Mm-hmm. Three men, this is funny. They said two men might be friends and leave the third man out. So four-man, like, squad was, like, ideal, mm-hmm. like, to have in the field and stuff.
Your battle buddy.
Yeah.
Battle buddies are a real thing, man. That's important.
Mm-hmm. Hey, you got to like the people you're going with, I guess, or at least respect them to be able to, you know.
Right. That's how you work well together.
And get the job done.
For sure.
Now you're making me, like, picture, like, four dudes out in, like, the bush hiding from Japanese forces, and they all hate each other.
I mean, I'm sure it's a good thing
I got this spare guy with us.
Yeah, I'm sure it happened sometimes, but they, you know, we're like, hey.
Four.
Yeah, they're like four America.
You got four.
I'll use this guy I hate as a distraction.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, more on who these people exactly were. As we said earlier, you know, some of them, they were some missionaries, a lot of managers, people in the local area. There was also some cattle station managers and plantation managers, just anybody who knew the area well, anybody who was around. What they did is, well, they were supported by all three of the services, the aircraft, the Army, and the Navy. So the Air Force would drop them supplies that they needed, and if they needed to be landed in an area, they would land using submarines or PT boats. Some of the intel that they would gather was bombing raids or reporting on enemy locations, either air or surface, or any movements that were of value. Some interesting as well, they also rescued downed airmen and shipwrecked sailors. So not only, you know, they're looking out for the enemy, but, you know, you also know that you think about it like you get downed in an aircraft or you're hoping the coast watchers will find you.
Oh, yeah, you got someone down.
You got somebody who's actually watching. So
you got hope.
It's multi-purposed.
Also, wasn't JFK rescued by the coast watchers?
There was somebody, or at least one of the natives. Yeah. And like, as we said earlier, the Ferdinand Code, they're strictly ordered not to fight. Anybody recognize that? That is actually Ferdinand based on the bull that wanted to sniff flowers out in the fields.
Oh, and like the movie?
Well, the movie, but it was before that as well, probably. Right. But yeah, no, that is the same Ferdinand. Strictly not fighting, not getting themselves into unnecessary danger. Mm-hmm. They would either utilize existing radios or teleradios that were given to them, tuned in onto a rarely used frequency to try and avoid detection. It was definitely kind of a lonely, like, isolated job, but it was very necessary in World War II.
Oh, for sure.
And they had a lot of strict instructions, codes to report on, and hostile movement. More on those.
Real spy shit. Huh?
Yeah, real spy stuff.
They took secrecy as like one of the most important things that you could do. When reporting in the code, they had to know what parties were involved and approximately where. To know where, they mostly had natives there that knew where the actual, where like the land was, because they knew about it. They used what's called the PRVC or the Playfair or PRNC, which is the Playfair Royal Naval Code. It started off as a group of five letter combinations, but then as time went on, it got shortened down to numbers and letters. For example, some of them are O-8, which is Major General, or O-9, which is Lieutenant General.
It's interesting, then, like a list, you know, hold on to.
Yeah. O-10 is just General. And then one of the most common ones was PL for plain language, mm-hmm. which after they said PL, then they could just talk, basically.
Right.
Then any code that was longer than maybe like a couple words, they would just use Morse code. Because as in the Navy, they just knew it.
It's go back to the basics.
Like universally, that's classic.
Yeah.
Translatable.
Man.
They used, along with radios, they used signal lamps, flags, and even smoke signals. They had three steps. They did three steps whenever they had a signal and they needed to relay it to like a ship or somewhere else.
That's cool.
They would receive the signal. They would decode it. Then they would transmit it to the intended recipient. Some of the challenges that they faced were the risk of being discovered.
Yeah.
Oh, I'd say that's number one.
Yeah, that's like the number one.
You can see why only like those who are qualified are able to do this. It's
I wouldn't want to get picked up by a Japanese group of soldiers.
And interrogated and stuff.
The Japanese were brutal in World War II.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then there's like not getting the codes right and all that. So it was definitely a big thing.
It's kind of stressful a little bit.
Yeah. Especially with going back like into town to get to get supplies, and then like as you were saying earlier, just communicating with the town's members, saying that this is who I am.
Oh yeah,
that's what I'm here for.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is navigating through the islands, because sometimes there were soldiers of the Navy not being familiar with any of the land.
You could get lost out there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's why
it would definitely suck to be lost in the jungle with Japanese.
Oh, yeah. Especially with equipment and stuff you got to get through it with. Like these just small trails that aren't really used, like, you know, used for big equipment.
For sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They had to deal with unpredictable weather because they had to be there for World War II, which was like a strain of like 10 years.
Out there
basically.
In the Pacific as well.
Yeah. And being in the Pacific, which is just pretty much islands. And then they had to endure isolation and limited supplies, because at the beginning, before they would actually have to fight, they would have to just sit there hours upon hours just with their groups. Because as you said, they could be one person all the way up to four people in a group.
I would say, too, that especially sitting there, I feel like it's also not even just a risk of, like, you know, getting discovered, but also of like kind of letting your guard down.
Yeah.
Because like if you're there for a while and you're like, hey,
you might get complacent.
Yeah, it's been a couple weeks. Nothing's really been going on.
Like, you haven't been discovered yet.
Yeah, anything could happen.
Yeah, so it's just you discovered. And three other people, you know?
Yeah, I mean, anything could happen at that point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's is there anything else there?
No, that's pretty much it.
All right, well, this was our... this was our little talk about the Pacific Coast Watchers of World War II. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kellen, and this is goodbye, I suppose.
Goodbye.
Sayonara.